Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer and audio gear manufacturer Stephen Slate. But first of all, there's something significant that just happened everybody should know about because it's going to change the balance of the music industry somewhat. Since the beginning of the year, more people have been getting their music from music streams than they have been from YouTube. Now, what's been found is that about 114 billion streams, and this includes Spotify and Apple Music and Deezer and just about anything you can think of, there's 114 billion streams versus about 95 billion music views on YouTube. And this is the largest amount of music consumption since the beginning of MTV. Now, again, MTV was 1982, so this is, almost 35 years ago. This is very significant. The fact of the matter is, people are more and more willing to pay to get their music. It's a really good thing. It's going to be great for artists, for labels, for bands. And it's just the tip of the iceberg. It's actually going to get better from here. Now, as a result of all of this, however, YouTube is feeling the heat. Google has offered some killer deals in order to get people interested, and they started with Google Play. Now, Google Play, of course, is their on-demand streaming music site. And what they're doing is they're giving away 4 free months if you sign up for the first year. So basically, you're getting the first year for $40. Beyond that, they're also throwing in YouTube Red. And YouTube Red, of course, is the service that YouTube came out with hoping to convert a lot of people from getting their music views for free to something that's paid. And it hasn't really worked. As a matter of fact, it is growing. It's growing by about 5 or 10% a month. That being said, it only reaches about 10% of all of YouTube users. So they have a long, long way to go, and it looks like they're losing ground. And as a result, YouTube Red now has a special deal as well for 99 cents a month. What all this means is the fact that Google is feeling the heat, and for the first time, YouTube is not the king of the mountain, which is a really good thing when it comes to royalties for musicians, artists, content creators, bands, and record labels. Let's see what happens in the coming months as YouTube begins to descend a little bit and we find that streaming music, especially from Spotify, and you're going to see more and more from Apple Music and, of course, more from Deezer. And those of you who haven't heard of Deezer yet, that's Spotify's biggest competitor out of Europe, and they're now beginning to show their strength in North America. So that's going to be an interesting competitor in the future. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks program and my other online video courses at bobbyosinskicourses.com, as well as my music industry blog at music3.0.com, music industry production blog at bobbyosinskiblog.com, or you can just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links or read excerpts from my books. Another interesting thing that just happened was Rain Corporation was just purchased by InMusic. Now, Rain makes some very interesting gear. The company started in 1982 as an audio company that was making equalizers and small mixers and things like that. And they made the smart left turn of going into the contractor business. Rain has always made great product, bulletproof product. But because it was bulletproof, it also meant it was a little more expensive, so it didn't quite work when it came up against cheaper audio products from Alesis, for instance, or products that came out of China. So Rain made this left turn into the contractor business and then later into the DJ business, and they make some great products. Again, everything is bulletproof. It's well engineered, and best of all, it's made in the USA. All that being said, Rain has been purchased by InMusic. And InMusic already owns 13 audio companies like Denon and Alesis, Akai, M-Audio, Newmark, Marantz. This is a good fit, actually, for them. And the reason why this is all happening is because the founders and the owners of Rain are retiring. One of the bad parts of all this is something that we see over and over in this business. And that's all of a sudden there's going to be some good workers that are going to be displaced. So we're going to see 60 plus employees of Rain suddenly out of a gig at the end of the month as manufacturing gets moved to China. Recently, we saw this happen with Tannoy. Again, Tannoy, with about 60 people or so, has been in Scotland forever. The company was just purchased. First of all, it was purchased by the TC Group, and then the TC Group was purchased by Behringer. And then, of course, everything was moved to Behringer City in China. So there's all those very skilled workers that were out of business. This is, again, a theme that we're seeing over and over in the audio business, and it's really a shame to see this happen with Rain. But perhaps on the upside, InMusic is actually a pretty good company. It's very stable, and it's managed to take the companies that I mentioned before and actually make them thrive. So aside from the fact that there's going to be some good people losing work and manufacturers going to be moved to China, at least you can take heart in the fact that hopefully the good intentions of Rain will still remain. My guest today is Stephen Slate, whose story begins in the studio as an engineer, to making custom drum samples for producers, to manufacturing some of the most innovative gear on the market today. I spoke with him via phone from his studio in Los Angeles. How did you get your start in music? I want to know the Stephen Slate backstory.
So the Stephen Slate backstory kind of starts out with me really wanting to be a rock star. I think that's kind of a common story amongst a lot of audio engineers. I don't think anyone gets into this saying, hey, you know, I want to, you know, work with emotional singers and hungover drummers and make some kind of music behind a piece of glass. I think it starts off, you're playing an instrument, you're into some type of, musical instrument, and you've got aspirations to be a musician. And it's somehow, somewhere, that takes a turn, and you're in the, you know, you're recording your band's demos, or you're in the studio with your band, and you're realizing, wow, the studio is actually a pretty interesting place, too. And then you kind of catch this bug where you, like, just become obsessed with, making things sound good and making music. And that's kind of what happened to me, and I talked to a lot of guys in similar shoes. And that's what it came down to. I was a musician. I was playing in several bands. I was recording my own music with cassette 4-tracks, which then went to a little digital 8-track, then went to an 8-at. And then I started, hey, well, this studio stuff's fun. You know, as a part-time job in high school, maybe I'll find a local studio who can use some help. And by help, I realized that the first part of help in a recording studio is getting coffee, or maybe it's tarring a roof, but whatever. At least it got me in the space, you know. That's really what happened. I was a musician turned audio engineer, and then I started making stuff, and that took me to my final turn, which is, you know, an audio engineer who makes stuff.
Did you have a mentor when you were in the studio? Was there something that you learned that really...
You know, I had a lot of mentors. Yeah. I mean, I worked at studios from the time I was like 15 or 16 all the way through when I was about 21 or 22. Early on, I had a great guy who... I grew up in New Jersey, so the first studios I worked in was Union, New Jersey. There was just this engineer who was just so interesting because he was just cool about teaching. He didn't mind, even in the middle of a client session, to stop and explain what the hell he was doing and why, and he allowed me to enter his brain a little bit, and I thought that was extremely helpful. So not all engineers are like that, especially with young assistants who are, you know, 15, 16. They're not going to take the time to, you know, explain stuff. But he did, and it was really important to me.
Where did you grow up in New Jersey, out of curiosity?
Westfield. It's in Union County, about 25, 30 minutes south of Manhattan, depending on how fast you drive.
Yeah, I think I played a club up there during back in my playing days somewhere. It sounds very familiar. Well, that's cool. How did you make it out to California?
So my first pit stop was Boston. I went to school there, started a little underground recording studio in Roxbury, and played in bands there. And then I started doing some pretty decent records, worked on some cool records for some cool bands, and I came out to LA to work with this one band, and I brought my band out here, and I said, man, the weather is a lot nicer here than it is in Boston, and the opposite sex didn't look so bad either, so I said, I can probably hang here for a bit, and that was 11 years ago.
I know just what you mean. I made basically the same trick. I started in Pennsylvania, went to New Jersey, and I lived there for a while, and then went to Boston and went to school up there, and then made it out to California. Same thing.
Yeah.
And you know what? There's only four places that you can go if you want to be in the music business, and that's London.
Yeah.
It's Nashville. It's New York or L.A., and L.A. certainly has the best weather. So, yeah, I'm with you there.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love the L.A. weather, man. Everyone, you know, asked me, oh, well, you know, isn't it weird that you live in L.A. and there's no seasons? You know, a lot of my East Coast friends are like, oh, there's no seasons. And I go, there is seasons. It's nice, and really nice. So that's the only four seasons that I need, you know?
Yeah, I'm there with you, definitely. So how did you get into making gear? Because it's a big jump.
It is it's an interesting jump, and in some cases it's a big jump. And the way I did it was because, you know, by the time I got to California, I really wanted to become a protege to a major producer or mixer. That was the goal. The goal was, you know, I remember reading your books, and I think one or two of the guys, the pros in your books, you know, mentioned that they were, you know, proteges of other very successful producers and came up in the industry that way. So that was my plan. Now, here's the way I did that plan. The way I executed that plan was that I made this little CD of one-shot drum samples that I put onto an MCI GH24, and these really, you know, EQ'd out, compressed, wacky drum samples with, you know, a bunch of room sound on them that I'd recorded in Boston. And I printed a bunch of CDRs with these, you know, five or six kick and snare samples. And I would start to find out where there were music industry parties where some producers or mixers might hang. And I'd go to these parties and I'd hand out these CDs to whoever I could. Hoping that the goal again was that one of these guys would say, all right, well, this guy obviously is, you know, a pretty motivated young chap. Let's make him the protege. But the plan kind of backfired, Bob, because what ended up happening was I did get phone calls from a few pretty big producers and some pretty big mixers, but they just wanted more drum samples. You know, they didn't want me to be their protege. They didn't even mention that. They just said, hey, can you make me a snare that's slightly more cracky? I really like what you did here, but can you do this and do that? So the next thing I know, I'm customizing drum samples and for all these big guys, and I'm hearing a lot of these drum samples start to appear on big records, lots of big records. And, you know, and it was pretty exciting. And that kind of became my thing. I was just the drum sample dude. I mean, I was starting to get a lot of calls from a lot of people, and my name started getting out there as the dude who makes the drum samples. So then, in about 2006, somewhere around there, I said, well, this doesn't really make sense making drum samples just for about five or six pros in L.A. Let's see what this internet has to offer. Let's offer to anyone who will give me, I think it was $200 or something like that. So that was my first product. It was just a CDR that I wrote on with a Sharpie. What it was, it just said Steven Slate drums, 44.1 kilohertz wave files. Put a website on there, and I would every single day I would take orders on the website, and I'd go to the post office on Santa Monica and Fairfax and send these out in yellow envelopes. And that was my business, Steven Slate drums. That was the first product. Now, how does that branch into more things? Well, I mean, again, just like you catch the bug from going to a musician to being an audio engineer, I caught the bug from being, you know, an audio engineer into making a guy who makes stuff. I mean, that was also a fascinating thing for me, and it really intrigued me, and it excited me, and it thrilled me just to make stuff and have people give you feedback and say, hey, I used your stuff to do some type of cool music and make some cool art, and I liked it. So I kept on going with it, and, you know, later on started develop, you know, found some, you know, some team members to work on some more complex software with. I found some great hardware engineers to start making hardware, and then of course it blows up into this big thing, which it is now.
Well, where did you go from the drums then? Was the next thing was plugins, right?
Yeah, so I met Fabrice Gabriel, and then I also met a few really talented folks in another development team. So Slate is actually two companies. It's kind of complicated because there's Slate Digital, which is my partnership with Fabrice Gabriel. We make all the Slate Digital products, the new microphone, a lot of the new analog model plugins. And then there's Yellow Matter Entertainment, which is my own company, which has a few different subdivisions, which does the drum software and does trigger software, does the Ravens, and does that stuff. But the next step I did was, it was kind of simultaneous. You know, meeting Fabrice, doing plugins with him. I met the programmers who I do trigger with, and we started doing that. I met Greg St. Regis and Tim Caswell. We started making hardware. We made the Dragon Dynamics processor. Then we made the Fox Mic Pre. So kind of everything started to shoot out all at once, really. It was a big undertaking of just a lot of different projects happening simultaneously, and I kind of haven't stopped since.
Well, let's go back for a second to the plugins. So how did you decide exactly what you wanted to do there?
That's a good question. And when Fabrice and I first met, it was an interesting thing that was happening. So, again, I was still, you know, engineering quite a bit. And remember, it's 2007 maybe at the time, 2008 maybe. There was the height of the loudness wars where every record was getting smashed. Now, remember, I'm a guy who likes drums. I like transients. I like to put the volume up in a record, and I want to feel the kick and snare punch me in the chest. That wasn't happening in 2008. Everything was being obliterated. I mean, there's a lot of master engineers just were kind of trying to figure out how to make things loud without smashing things to bits, and it was really tough. So Fabrice and I met, and we both started complaining about that. Now, what I told him was that I kind of figured out a way around it, which was clipping high-end converters, which was actually the technique that a lot of high-end master engineers were doing to make stuff loud while keeping the punch. Because if you clip the transients rather than squash them with a limiter, you can actually retain more punch. But there was a diminishing return from clipping, which was you'd get distortion if you went too much or if you had too much, you know, bursts of low frequencies. So it wasn't ideal, but it was working for some guys. In fact, some master engineers their preferred method is just to clip the and put up a lavery or you know, some type of prism converter. Anyway, so I complained to him about that, and he said, you know what? I have been complaining about the same thing. So I've been working on my own type of clipping saturator, and we should talk more about it. So we started talking about, you know, the problems with limiting versus clipping, and we decided that we were going to make a plugin that kind of did something a little bit in between, but did things a little smarter. So the first thing we did was FGX, which, you know, basically to sum FGX up, it's an optimized saturator, which creates a clipping saturation curve, but it optimizes it for the type of curve that is in its look ahead. So a snare drum will get saturated with a particular type of curve that is unique from the type of curve that would be saturating a kick drum, which has obviously a lot of low frequency content. So that was FGX. And it was a really big hit right from the get-go. And that was the first, you know, plugin we made. And then following that, that's when we really all, you know, dove right into the analog modeling, because I immediately understood that, you know, problem one was the loudness processors were really, really crapping out my sound. Problem two was, why in, you know, 2008 do I still have to mix through this big old giant mixing board just to get things to sound right? What's going on with the digital stuff? So the second plug we made was Virtual Console Collection, which basically takes all of the nonlinearities of, you know, classic vintage mixing consoles and throws them into the digital workstation. And it's still our best-selling plugin today, that second plugin.
From there, you've done quite a number of other plugins. I just looked, and there was, wow, a boatload of them. How do you decide which plugins are you going to do? Is it random coming from your, and I shouldn't say random, does it come from the need that you have when you're doing a project? Is it coming from your customers that are asking for something, or does it just seem like it should be market driven?
I think it's a bit of all of the above. You know, there's clearly some things where I'm like, oh man, we need this. VCC, the Virtual Console Collection, that was me going, we need to do this. This is absolutely, and it came from my own work. You know, I was doing a record for some big 80s rock star, you know, that I was doing, and I was mixing stuff through my analog console, and, you know, he would love a mix. Then the next day and then the next week he'd say, oh, well, that mix I loved last week, well, I redid the solo for it, so can we recall that? And I must have recalled, like, every single mix 20 times, and they redid stuff, and I said, this is not how it should be. So the VCC was definitely, you know, straight out of my own desires and necessities. Other plugins are just more about being, you know, like you said, market driven. What are people looking for? What do they need? What do they want? What are the customers, you know, saying to me? And I communicate a lot with customers. I really try to keep my ears close to the voice of the industry, whether I'm going on forums like Gear Sluts or going on Facebook or going through, you know, I have a customer email that I go through, and I just really try to find out what people are thinking, what people need, you know, what works for people, what doesn't. You know, a big issue for us is also, you know, complexity versus simplicity. That's always an issue. You know, how deep do people want to dive, or is there a product where people just want to be able to turn knobs and make music happen and make things right? So that's also something that we take into careful consideration.
How about the hardware? Because now you're doing a compressor and you're doing a mic amp, and there's tons of those already out there. So
the compressor, Just to let you know, the compressor, the Dragon, and the mic amp, those came out in about, I think, 2009, 2010. Now, those were great back then. Now, since my heart is really more into the virtual side of things, I know I sold Slate Pro Audio to the guy who co-designed a lot of that gear, Tim Caswell and Greg St. Regis, Studio Electronics. So we no longer distribute that stuff, but it's great gear. But now the hardware we do is mostly focused, again, on virtual stuff. So our biggest, product right now is the Raven touchscreens, as well as the virtual microphone systems.
All right, well, let's go there. The Raven.
Sure.
Unbelievable idea. I'm forever baffled how you could actually bring in a touchscreen, a multi-touchscreen, with the software that you have, the integration of the various DAWs, at the price you do. I mean, that's amazing to me.
Well, I appreciate that. I personally don't, not to try to sound like I'm trying to be overly humble, but I don't think the idea was that remarkable. I mean, hell, at the time the Raven came out, we'd all had touchscreens in our pockets. And to me, I was like, this just seems rather obvious. We have this, amazing digital studio on our computer screen, and yet we're still trying to break the computer screen off to these generic hardware boxes to manipulate them. Why don't you just touch the screen and manipulate the screen since it's all there? So to me, the idea was pretty self-explanatory. In terms of price, that was an important thing. When we first came out with the MTX, it was $16,000, and even the little guy, the MTI, which came out soon after, was $2,500. But when I make these products, Bobby, I'm always trying to imagine, myself back in those Boston days, running that little underground studio, wanting all this cool stuff just so I can make some fun songs with some great bands. And $2,500, that's a serious price to pay. And I said, we've got to make this manageable. I want to keep improving the software, and I want this to be manageable. And we fought for about a year and a half, 2 years to try to figure out a solution that could be affordable. So we got the MTI down to $999. It supports every major DAW. The software integrates so beautifully. The screen is so slick, so smooth, so fast and reactive. And I'm just thrilled about that product. We launched it, the MTI 2 launched in December, and it sold astronomically well. We were had the unfortunate incident where our factory had in Taiwan had an earthquake, so it actually stopped production in February, and we are just now this week getting new units in, and we are heavily back ordered, but it's going to be a happy summer for us since we're finally going to be able to sell those great units again.
Okay, let me ask you something about the touchscreen and the development of it. One of the things that I personally am kind of dubious about, now, I haven't done a session on a Raven at all, so
sure,
take it for what it's worth. That being said, I also suffer from tennis elbow, and I look at that and I think, constantly reaching out and touching a screen, after a while, that's going to hurt. So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, anyway, now, I've since talked to other users who have said, no, it's laid out in such a way where most of what you're doing is down on the bottom of the screen, so you just have to rest your hands on the desk, and everything works from there. Which, when I heard that, I thought, that's brilliant. Okay, that kind of works. But still, I'm thinking, my elbows are going to hurt. So I'm sure you did testing on that prior to coming out with this, right?
Yeah, we did a lot of testing. There's a few things that help the ergonomics. One is the angle. We have a 40-degree classic drafting angle. So basically what that means is regardless of whether you're on the small one or the big one, your hands are always below your shoulders. So the blood's always going the proper way. As soon as you start to work where your hands are above your shoulders, that's when you start to get the gorilla arm. It's not good. So number one is the angle is really important. That's the classic drafter's angle. Number two, like you said, is a lot of the stuff you're touching is on the lower third of the screen, so that's definitely helpful. Number three, I think I'm on, is that, remember, we are mixing music. So it is not something where you are in constant motion, because you do a tweak, you'll move some stuff, and then you sit back and you listen. So you have constant breaks. If you actually look at yourself when you're mixing, you're not just, going 100%. You're sitting there, you're stopping, and you're analyzing. That's part of the music making process is analyzing, and those constant breaks are also what helps you. But the other issue is, someone mentioned, hey, I'm actually, moving stuff less than I was with my hardware controller. He was coming from a hardware controller to the Raven, because you said with the hardware controller, I'm navigating so many submenus because you only have, like, you know, usually five or less generic knobs and a bunch of menus, and you're constantly pressing and you're looking from the screen back to the controller, back to the screen, back to the controller. He goes, it was actually a lot more painful on my hands, neck, and up my eyes. And I would attest to that as well.
The resolution on the screen seems much better than I ever would have expected as well. I never would have thought you can get the increments that you get out of it, which that's pretty cool as far as I'm concerned.
That's an attest to my software programmers. To get that type of resolution, to get the smoothness of the faders, to get the feel of the way things move, really is about my programming. There's so much code, even just going into the way the faders move. And to get it to where it is today, I mean, the faders are at their version 3.0. And just comparing the faders 3.0 to the original faders 1.0, you feel a difference. Just when you move it, when you stop them, when you're doing small moves, and then you go from a small move maybe to a quick move, when you're doing multiple faders at once, all of these things are taken into account in the software programming. And my developers for Raven are just fantastic guys, and they really did a hell of a job, especially having to put up with me because I was pretty finicky about those faders.
Hey, that's pretty cool. It's the first big innovation that I can remember on a controller innovation in the business. Now, that being said, I can remember sitting with George Massenburg about 1984 or 85. And at the time, I was doing a lot of work with AMEC. Remember AMEC, the console company?
Sure, of course, yeah.
And I can remember sitting with those guys and George Massenburg, and George laying out his idea of something very similar. The only difference was it was basically a tabletop, and you were mixing from the tabletop. Almost like there's a big Microsoft Surface product.
Yeah, of course, I've seen it. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
But anyway, he was thinking about that, certainly not in the same way you are, but, you know, way back when. But nonetheless.
Well, something tells me if George had the technology at the time, I bet you he would have beat me to the Raven by quite a ways. Cause he's a pretty innovative guy, so I wouldn't doubt it.
Tell me about the virtual microphone. How did that come about?
The virtual microphone came about because I've always been a huge microphone fan. And one of the things, again, going back to that 21, 22-year-old in that Boston studio, you know, I was always trying to chase after the bands that always wanted to go to the bigger, more commercial, more pro studios. And what did these pro studios have? They had everything that I didn't. They had the cool toys. And so a lot of those cool toys were their cool microphone collections. And even as I ran my own studio, I would still assist at other studios, other commercial facilities, and would see the 47s and the C-12s and the 251s and the M49s and M269s. And I go, man, if only one day. And I'll never forget the time in Boston was where I bought my first U-47. And it cost me $3,000, which was pretty much like spending $1 million. Even though it's a hell of a deal for a U-47, it still seemed like I was spending $1 million.
Yeah.
And so fast forward, and, 10 years. And, I was listening to that U-47, and I said, what the hell is it that I like about this microphone? Is it that it's so clean and clear and precise? And I realized then, this is well into the time where Fabrice and I had done a lot of analog modeling, so I knew a lot about what made analog tone what it is. And I said, you know what? No, it's not. What makes this mic sound the way it does is its non-linearities.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, what would be the difference of this, of modeling a microphone and modeling the virtual console collection? Like, so the VCC takes the neutral DAW mixer that's sonically neutral, doesn't add or take away anything, and it adds this dynamic nonlinear artifacts to make it sound like a vintage console. So I thought to myself, what if we could start off with the same type of blank canvas? Then could we apply dynamic nonlinear artifacts and make it sound like different microphones? It was an interesting idea, I thought, and I wasn't sure if it could be done because I wasn't sure if the captured sound could be wide bandwidth and linear enough that it would actually take on the characteristics of a model microphone. I just wasn't sure. So I did some tests, and we built a prototype of this microphone that ended up becoming the ML1, which was just meant to be super flat, high bandwidth, and with a linear response. And then we started doing some measurements of my U-47, its dynamic frequency response, its phase response, the way the tube harmonics reacted to different incoming signals, of course, the different saturation and all these things. And then we did a test, and I took a listen. And I said, my God, it's like 90% there. Now imagine if we put a little more effort into this, I think we can get it 100%. So that was 2.5 years ago, and the virtual microphone system was released 2 months ago, and it has been heavily compared to many of the vintage mics that it models, and the reaction has been extremely positive, where even big-time pros like Ross Hogarth have said that the difference is negligible between, you know, our models and the actual mics.
Yeah, I was just looking at his quote, as a matter of fact, and Ross is one of those guys, he'll tell you like it is.
That's so funny you say that, because Ross has been beta testing our stuff for a while, and it's always the most intimidating to send stuff to Ross, because we know we are not going to get anything watered down, sugared down. We are going to get the real deal, and sometimes he's torn us to pieces. I mean, when we were in the early stages of our virtual tape machines, I remember him listening to it, and he kind of, you know, ripped us apart. He did not like the early stages of it. I remember even thinking, I was like, well, Ross, don't listen to what's doing in the bottom, but what do you think about the top? And he just said, no. Yeah, he really hated it, and which was why it was so much more gratifying when we finally finished that plugin, and now he loves that plugin. He uses it all over the place. But, I mean, Ross is the real deal.
Yeah.
And with the virtual microphone system, it was the first time I actually didn't have him listen to it before the product was released. We were shipping out product, the initial soft launch, which was going to Sweetwater. I said, and I had been procrastinating having him listen to it just because I was scared. I was like, I didn't want to hear bad news. I didn't want to hear it. And he was over at NRG, and he's recording this band called Future Villains. I said, Ross, I got a mic. Do you want to hear it? He goes, perfect. I have a U47 set up right now. Let's do an AB. I go, oh boy.
Yeah.
Here we go. So I brought it over there. He set up the two mics. We put them capsule against each other. Singer sang right in the middle of them. And we listened back, and pretty much the quote that you see in that ad is exactly what he said. In fact, I even recorded some of it on my iPhone because I wanted to remember it. You know, he was blown. He just says, "Dude, I'm blown away. It's right there. It's got the detail. It's got what's the word he's using in the quote? I can't remember right now. But he said some other aspect where he goes, this is a new frontier, and he said that it even captures the depth and the essence of the real mic. So. He loved it, and he ended up finishing the record with our mic. I think he actually put it to the 251 model, and he finished the Future Villains record with that microphone.
When you were modeling the various classic microphones,
yeah,
how did you do that exactly? Because now I've talked to boutique microphone manufacturers that have told me, and one in particular who said he went and he rented 12 C12s and kind of cherry-picked what he thought was the best one.
Sure.
In order to model. So did you do something like that?
We listened to tons of microphones, especially U47s. I must have listened to at least a dozen before I picked the right one. It was just actually pretty coincidental that NRG's was in the ballpark of what ours was. I mean, all 47s sound like they're brothers, but they're just brothers who went to, you know, slightly different directions. So they're all going to have this thing in the low mids and the mids. That's very, you know, common to 47s. Then you know, depending on the tube, depending on the aging, depending on lots of different, you know, factors, the top end, you know, how bright or not bright it is, that will vary a lot. You know, I've heard some 47s, which there's never a bright 47. You know, it's bright in the mids, but not in the very highs, you know, like a 251 or a C12 is. But there's varied degrees of top end on a 47. And the same thing actually with 251s. I mean, I believe it or not, there are such things as dull 251s.
Yeah.
You know, but I think the best condition 251s that I've heard have that beautiful, airy, bright top end, which is really nice. But yeah, there's lots of different mics, and we found a collector who pretty much did a lot of the hard work for us and found the best of the best. So that's what you get in the VMS.
That's awesome. Is there a project that you really long to do? Is there something that you're thinking, boy, before I stop doing this, this is really what I want to do?
You know, there is. I just haven't figured it out yet. I figure these things out as we go along. You know, the answer, you know, a year ago would have been, yes, I want to make virtual microphones. Before that, it would have been, hey, I want to make, you know, an analog model plug-in suite. You know, 2 years before that, it would have been, I want to take the whole workstation, make it a touchscreen. So it's out there, Bobby. It's definitely out there. But, you know, I haven't discovered the next one yet. We do have a lot of cool things coming in the fall. I will say that. Unfortunately, I can't quite talk about them yet, but we have some really, really exciting things happening. But I'm sure even after that, beyond that, there's more fun stuff out there. I'm a dreamer, you know. I like to think about fun stuff and think about how I can enhance people's lives with the way they make art, and that's what I'm passionate about, and it's something that's what I like to do every day. So the answer is yes. I just don't know what it is yet, but when I know what it is, I'm gonna shoot for the stars on it.
At a trade show or two, I saw Stephen Slate speakers.
Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting one. Well, that's an interesting point. So with speakers, I'm very, very particular. And I actually have kind of a slight vendetta against some of the speaker industry, because the problem I find is some of the cheaper speakers are just really not good. And it doesn't do young audio engineers any good service when they're trying to mix and they can't even hear what the hell is going on. I mean, some of these speakers are just really wacky, and I was like, man, I want to make a really good reference speaker, and I went in on it, and by the time I was halfway in, I realized that I was actually wrong. I was there's a bigger challenge than I realized when it comes to making a really good sound reproduction system. When making a really good speaker, you really need an amazing design, but you need high quality components that are expensive.
Yeah.
You know, the amplifiers are expensive. To get the really high quality good tweeters, the drivers, the cabinet designs, and then to make them even look decent, it's expensive. So I made speakers with a digital DSP in them, where, you know, you can change the phase, you can change the crossovers, you can change lots of things about them, and you can actually make them sound like various different speakers. These speakers, which were called the Siren D3s, were really incredible. They sounded amazing. We shot them out against speakers three times their price, and it was great. But here was the problem. The problem was, even though they could sound as good as a pair of speakers that would cost, you know, $40,000, $50,000, they were still a $15,000 pair of speakers. That's what they would have to be street priced.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm a realistic guy, and I talked to a lot of pro audio dealers, and I said, well, you know, out of a $15,000 pair of speakers, how many of those do you think you could sell, you know, every month? And the answer was slightly underwhelming and disappointing. And I said, you know, it's a lot of work to make these speakers. It would take a ton of time away from other projects that were doing really well, like Raven, like some of the plugins. So, you know, I had to be realistic. I said, well, you know, I could, you know, get into this business, spend a lot of time and see very little return, and also compromise my amount of time that I could offer to my other projects, or I could let it sit for a bit. So that's really what's happening. The speakers are actually sitting right in front of me. You know, hell, I still listen to mixes on them. And I've got a friend who I'm going to be one-offing a pair for, but he's going to be paying a lot of money for that one-off, but he doesn't care because he really likes them. But as of right now, my goal is to try to figure out, you know, get a little back to the drawing board. And if I do go back into the speaker business, I need to figure out how I can make something that everyone can afford, that I can be proud to put my name on, because really that's what it comes down to. I don't like making stuff that's so elite. And you can say, yeah, I make some of the Raven stuff is really expensive. Our Z3, which is our triple screen system, can go to about $30,000. But I'm happy that at least we do have a $999 piece that people can all experience that same type of technology. You know, so if I can figure out the same thing regarding the speakers, then you'll see another revision of the Siren D3 at some point in the future.
Well, bravo for that. Definitely for that philosophy anyway. Stephen, last question for you. What's the best piece of music business advice that you received from someone, or maybe you kind of figured out along the way?
I think the best piece of advice I can give is that you got to do music because you love it, not because you think it's going to make you a millionaire, not because you think it's going to make you famous, not because like you're like me when I was 13 trying to be a rock star thinking I was going to get a bunch of girls. You got to do music or do anything because you're so passionate about it that you can't do anything else. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with money. There's nothing wrong with making a career or living out of it. But that all comes first based on true passion and love and respect for the art. And once you really have that love and respect for the art, then you're willing to, you know, to fight for it. And that's when you're willing to really, you know, go the whole 9-10 yards and fight for it and become successful. And I see a lot of successful people who really base it around their passion and their love for the art. And I think that would be my advice. Do this because you have to.
Well, I can feel your passion in your products for sure, and certainly in speaking with you, because you exude the passion for the business, and certainly that's exactly what we need. We need more of that, if anything.
Well, thank you so much, Bobby. And again, you know, I owe you a lot because, you know, when I was sitting there, even though I was just messing with eight tracks of an ADAT and this little Alan Heath mixer trying to figure out how the hell to make this into a record, you know, being able to read, you know, your books and go, oh, so guys are busting stuff to a parallel bus and squashing it. I remember reading the New York compression trick and it blew my mind. I mean, it was just crazy, you know, stuff like that. Just,
yeah.
You know, your books were really an inside look to, you know, what the pros were doing. And back then there was nothing like that in the market. So I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen. Thanks. I really appreciate it. Well, hey, this has been great. I enjoyed speaking with you, and I hope we can do it again. And certainly the next time I'm at a trade show and you're there, I'm going to make a pest of myself so we can sit down and at least say hi.
I would absolutely love it. I insist that you do that.
To find out more about Stephen and his many products, go to slatedigital.com or slatemt.com. That's Slate, S-L-A-T-E-M-T, all in word. .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyosinski.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.